From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet cinematographer Haskell Wexler. He won Oscars for his work on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory. This year, he won the American Society of Cinematographers Lifetime Achievement Award. Also today, a film director who parodies her own work. We talk with Tamara Davis. She got her start making rock and rap videos. Her latest film satirizes gangster rap. It's called CB4. And world music commentator Milo Miles reviews a new recording by salsa singer India. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. There's been another bomb attack in India. A powerful explosion destroyed two apartment buildings in downtown Calcutta overnight, killing at least 25 people. Police say no one has claimed responsibility for the bombing, but they say it seems that the blast could be linked to Friday's wave of attacks in Bombay that killed more than 300 people. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen asked Congress today for $45 billion to complete the savings and loan bailout. If approved, the additional spending would bring the total cost of the cleanup to more than $200 billion. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Testifying before the House Banking Committee, Secretary Bentsen conceded that he was asking members to make a tough vote. But by approving the additional money, Bentsen said, they would be voting for depositors and for the safety of our financial institutions. Of the $45 billion that Bentsen is requesting, $28 billion would ensure that depositors in failed or soon-to-fail savings and loans get their money. The remaining $17 billion would finance a new insurance fund. Although he didn't offer any promises, Secretary Bentsen said he believes this will be the last time he will have to ask Congress to pay for the S&L bailout. "We believe our request is sufficient to complete the job," said Bentsen, "once and for all." This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
The Tennessee National Guard says helicopter crews have found the last eight campers from a Michigan school group who had been stranded in the Great Smoky Mountains. Officials say 16 others were rescued earlier today. In all, some 117 people from the school were caught in the area by last weekend's major snowstorm. They were there for their annual spring break survival training course. The FBI says authorities have met with two members of the Branch Davidian sect outside Waco, Texas. From member station KERA, Bill Siebel reports.
This was the first meeting of its kind since the standoff began 17 days ago. All past negotiations had been on the phone. But FBI Special Agent Dick Swenson says those hadn't been very productive, so federal agents requested a face-to-face meeting. Two Branch Davidians and two law enforcement negotiators met yesterday afternoon, 60 yards from the compound. The discussions, however, covered nothing new. David Koresh was not at this hour-long meeting. Agent Swenson said negotiations continue, but progress is slow.
They want to talk, I think, in my opinion, again, in small pieces, as opposed to the far-ranging how to end this thing in totality.
FBI Agent Swenson added there's also the overlying problem of Koresh waiting for God's word. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Siebel in Dallas.
An early morning fire raged through a residence hotel in Chicago this morning, killing at least 14 people. Two of the people died when they jumped out windows to get away from the flames and smoke. Other residents tied sheets together and climbed out upper floor windows. Fire officials say flames apparently climbed up both of the hotel's stairwells. On Wall Street, stocks were mixed today, the Dow Jones Industrial inching up. This is NPR News from Washington. The Clinton administration said today a return to communism or authoritarian rule in Moscow would be alarming. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said that such concerns make Russia's continuation on the path of reform very important to the U.S. The statement comes as administration officials work on an aid package for the government of President Boris Yeltsin. Among the elements of the package are increased monetary aid, a restructuring of debt, and easier access to international lending institutions. Meanwhile, Russian President Boris Yeltsin stressed the urgency of an early meeting of the Group of Seven Nations proposed by French President François Mitterrand today. The Russian leader warned that his reforms were in serious danger from hardliners in the Congress trying to restore a communist regime. Kathleen Hunt reports.
In another appeal for Western aid to help Russia's floundering reforms, President Yeltsin wrapped up his one-day summit with the French president by warning that Russia was heading toward the edge of an abyss, and it would be too late to wait until the annual summit of the G7 industrialized nations in July to discuss an aid package for Russia. In his first public appearance since storming out of the Congress session last week, Yeltsin told reporters that despite pressure from the conservative legislature, he did not plan to change his foreign policy, which nationalists and communists accuse of being too pro-West. But he did say that he would make some changes in ministerial postings, which he'd planned before the stormy Congress. Meanwhile, letters and cables have been coming in from Yeltsin supporters all over Russia, demanding that he take strong measures to control the country and prevent the conservative legislature from rolling back the reforms. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
And again on Wall Street, stocks were mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials gained half a point to close at 3442.95. Declines edged advances in heavy trading of 217 million shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up by 0.3 of a point at 695.5. This is NPR News from Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year, the American Society of Cinematographers gave its Lifetime Achievement Award to Haskell Wexler. It was the first time an active cinematographer received the honor. A retrospective of Wexler's work will be presented at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York next month. Wexler won Oscars for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory, received an Oscar nomination for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Meet Juan. His other films include Colors, Coming Home, The Hoodlum Priest, America, America, and In the Heat of the Night. He also directed some very controversial documentaries, including Introduction to the Enemy, about the trip Jane Fonda made to North Vietnam during the war. Wexler wrote, directed, and shot Medium Cool, a 1970 feature film about a TV news cameraman during the riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. During the 40 years that Wexler has worked in film, the technology has changed dramatically. When he was starting out, he shot in black and white and had to use ingenuity when he didn't have the technology to get the shot he wanted.
Well, when I started, we had just the camera and the person mostly, and if you wanted to do a dolly shot, particularly working in Chicago where I began, you'd get in the back of the trunk of a car and you'd have a friend drive the car, or you'd get in some kid's little wagon that he plays with and have someone pull that for dolly shots. Lighting was very primitive, and still it was really the way to learn, because sometimes some of the modern technology is so extreme and so compartmentalized that we lose sight of exactly what we're doing.
Is there a shot for a feature film that you did in a kid's wagon getting pulled along?
Oh, I used to do that all the time. In fact, I kept a wagon that was a young boy lived next door to me, and I kept his wagon until he was about 18 years old and used it on a number of documentaries in Chicago.
But not feature films?
No, in feature films, even on Virginia Woolf, I had a thing which the grips called the paraplegic, which was a wheelchair thing that I had made up years before, where I could stand on this bicycle-like device and be pushed down the hall and then step off it with a handheld camera. I used it in a shot where Richard Burton goes down the hall to get a gun in a closet, and I wanted to get some excitement. The hallway was too narrow for the dollies that they had at that time, so it was quite useful.
You did one of the early helicopter shots for films, and thinking of the last shot in the movie Picnic, and you were the second unit cinematographer on that. Would you describe the shot and how you did it?
Well, the helicopter was a U.S. Navy helicopter. There were no civilian helicopters available to film companies, and so they just made some stuff out of 2x4 wood, and I would straddle a 2x4 out from the helicopter with the camera on a what we call a hi-hat, which is a low metal stand. We were shooting CinemaScope on that film, which is anamorphic, so the lens is very big, and of course the camera in those days were very heavy, I had a rope around my waist, and the rope was attached into the helicopter in case I fell off. And the shot was a shot that began with Kim Novak going out of a house and getting into a bus. And then it was supposed to go over the countryside and find a freight train on which Bill Holden was standing. And then after seeing a good look at the freight train, the camera was supposed to move up into the sky for the end credits.
So let me get this straight. You were not in the helicopter, but dangling outside of it on a 2x4?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there's a still picture of me. I had forgotten it, actually, because that's just, I didn't think anything of it. Yeah, we'd sit on it like on a horse, on a 2x4, and holding onto the camera.
Gee, what did it feel like? It must have been a real dizzying feeling.
Well, you know, the whole idea of fear when you're looking through the camera is a different phenomenon. I mean, I've been in wars and riots and hung out of many helicopters in the early days, and there's a detachment that happens when you look through the camera. You're looking for the shot, and it's only in recent years that I think about myself as being a vulnerable human being, even if I am a cameraman.
What do you think of that now, because you've gotten older?
Well, yeah, I don't do helicopter shots anymore. I just think maybe my time is running out as far as, because there have been a number of accidents and of cameramen hurting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once in a Western I was shooting, that stuntman was supposed to jump off a cliff, and he actually was supposed to fall off the cliff, and he did it extremely poorly. It was a low-budget Western, so I was very angry, and I said, damn it, this is how you do it. I'm going to do a terrific shot. So I had a little hand camera, and I jumped off this cliff, and there was a big mattress about 15 feet below, which I was supposed to fall on, but I didn't. And I just sort of nicked it and then rolled down the rest of the hillside. And they took me to the hospital. And all the way to the hospital and everything, I said, oh, God, I don't care. I got the greatest, most real jump-off shot that ever was. Then when we did see the shot, all it was, you just see some blur of sky and some bushes. And it was, it may have been realistic, but it wasn't a good shot.
Now, you were a cinematographer on the film Gimme Shelter, which was the concert film at the Altamont Festival.
Terror. I have to explain. I was not the cinematographer on Gimme Shelter. I was going to be, and I met with Mick for a week and a half while they were trying to figure out where they were going to have the concert. And then at the last minute, I was worried because, well... because things were so up in the air and I was around so many weird people. It was weird to me at that time, you know, with teeny boppers and grass being smoked and all kinds of crazy things going on, that I called my friends the Maisels in New York, and the Maisels shot Gimme Shelter.
Oh, so you didn't work on it?
No, I didn't work on it. I did give refuge to the Maisels after the concert because the... I'm trying to think of how much of this I should say. the people who were involved in the killing that happened at Altamont threatened the lives of the Maisels, and so they hid out at my place in Malibu, and until they were able to work a deal to buy them a new Harley Davidson. And then the death threat against the Maisels was released.
So these people wanted the Maisels dead unless they destroyed the footage?
Well, they said that they were life actors in the Maisels film, and they wanted to be paid $40,000 for being life actors in a dramatic film.
Huh.
This was the Hell's Angels. I'm sure none of them are around anymore.
Right.
It was settled. A digger named Emmett Grogan worked the transaction for us so that the Maisels, the contract on the measles was lifted.
My guest is cinematographer Haskell Wexler, and he this year got the American Society of Cinematographers Lifetime Achievement Award. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I guess a cinematographer, Haskell Wexler. He won Academy Awards for his work on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory, and he got Oscar nominations for his work on Matewan and Blaze. You've done a lot of documentary work throughout your career. On your feature medium, Cool, which you wrote, directed, and shot, you used documentary footage, even though it was a fiction feature film. And part of the documentary footage that you used was of the organizing at the Chicago Convention and the riots there. You were actually shooting during some tear gassing, and you got gassed while you were shooting.
Yes, I did. And so did some members of our crew. There was no actually stock footage in Medium Cool. I wrote the script. I wrote the riots. And I integrated the actors in the film in the park during the demonstrations. But nowhere was it like we had stock footage and then later in editing integrated in the film. It was all done at the time.
So when you were shooting the demonstration that ended up getting tear gas and you got gassed yourself, I imagine you had to stop shooting then.
Yes, I had to stop shooting. I certainly didn't know that tear gas felt like it has, like it does. I don't know whether you've ever experienced it, but when you hear the word tear gas, you think, well, your eyes will burn and that's it. But that whole feeling of your skin burning, that you can't breathe, you can't inhale, you feel suffocated, it's a very, very terrifying experience.
One of the issues in Medium Cool is, does being behind the camera, shooting the action, remove you from the action and remove you from any responsibility for what happens? Was that a big issue for you personally?
Yes, I think that the whole voyeuristic attitude of filmmakers, or of me personally, of shooting documentaries and so forth, is an important issue, and it was an important issue to me personally. And the whole question of when do you put the camera down, and or when do you keep shooting to get the shot? And a number of times in my life, I've had that question hit me very hard. When I was in Vietnam with Jane Fonda, I was shooting a farmer in the field, just a pastoral scene. And while I was shooting him, an explosion occurred. He blew up right in my lens, so to speak. And he had stepped in a landmine, and some people came out. They were like paramedics, came out from a little clinic and carried him in to this little house where they treated him with herbs and things. And I was shooting all this time, and there was only one guy who was helped to pull him, and I had to think whether I was going to keep shooting or help the guy. And so I kept shooting, and then they put him in this little clinic, and I photographed through the window while they had to amputate his leg. And I felt very strange because I felt I could have helped, but I didn't help. But then I also felt elated that I was getting a shot that would be important to the film.
Looking back, are you sorry that you kept shooting instead of helping?
I try not to think about it because mm-hmm. I rationalize out, well, how much help could you really be, you know? And maybe if people saw this, they'd realize the brutality of war and figure out there's got to be some better way than killing human beings who are just trying to farm a field.
You've done a lot of political documentaries. But you've also done hundreds of TV commercials. Is that a contradiction at all? Especially considering that the documentaries have been for, anti-imperialist causes. You've done a lot of documentaries in Vietnam, Central America. Mm-hmm. So is there any conflict in your mind between, selling your services for a lot of money to make commercials and then, doing things probably at your own expense that were documentaries about politics?
Well, there is a contradiction in a sense. If you're making commercials which sell products which are unhealthy or which are unnecessary, I think that you are part of a system. I am part of a system which encourages people to buy things and do things which are not to their best interest. And to that extent, you could say it was contradictory.
Some of the many commercials that you've shot over the years were for Marlboro cigarettes. You did a lot of the Marlboro Man campaign, right?
Oh.
Can you talk a little bit about getting what? what were you going to say?
So you looked me up pretty good.
Yeah, we got your number. But I'm really interested, since that became such an iconic commercial, and then it became so controversial afterwards because one of the Marlboro men got cancer. Lung cancer. So can you talk a little bit about creating the image, creating the icon?
Well, of course, the general idea was dreamed up by the advertising agency. And my job was to realize that. And we went down to Lubbock, Texas, usually, and onto a ranch, and we'd pick cowboys who looked the part and photograph them under dramatic situations, rounding up wild horses or running through streams and then reaching in and taking a drag on a cigarette. Now, I have to, in my defense, I have to say that the general knowledge of the deadly nature of cigarettes was not primarily in my mind, nor was it on these poor cowboys, who many of whom have died of emphysema since we were shooting. I do notice that American tobacco companies have big campaigns overseas now, and we are making cigarette addicts out of millions of Chinese, and without the necessity of putting any Surgeon General report on them.
When you were younger, you joined the Merchant Marines. Why did you go to sea?
Well, it was patriotic, for one thing. It was just the beginning of World War II, and my dad had been in the Navy, and I just, I think I preferred that from my image of digging around in the mud like a grunt. I would prefer fighting the war from ships.
Mm-hmm. Now, a ship that you were on was torpedoed. I believe this was off the coast of Africa. And you were wounded, and you were on a lifeboat for 14 days with, I believe, 17 other men. Is that right? Do I have that right?
I don't know where you're reading all this stuff, but it's pretty accurate. Yes, it was in 1942. I was on a ship called the Excello, coming back from the Red Sea, and we were sunk off the coast of Africa by a German submarine, and was in a lifeboat for 14 days, and landed and lived with the Pondos in South Africa while. Who took care of us and took care of me. I had some wound in my left leg.
Just give me a sense of what it was like to be on that raft for 14 days. Were you sitting? Were you lying? Was there room for your whole body to stretch out? Were you in a lot of pain?
Well, I was, I think I was 19, and we were in a lifeboat, not in a raft, and we were jammed in the first couple of nights with difficult because there were heavy swells. And I had a thing like a bicycle pump, which is a bilge pump-like thing to pump the water that was coming in the lifeboat. And I had one of the guys, the saloon messman, I asked him to hold a hose over the side because it had a curl in it, and I had to pump, and I pumped with my right arm until it gave out, and pumped to my left until it gave out. And then I noticed that he had collapsed and that the hose was not going over the side of the lifeboat, but went back into the lifeboat. And I think that was the only time that I really felt like I wanted to give up. And then we had chief engineer, a guy named Finnegan, who came back. He was an older guy, and he came back because we needed chief engineers at that time. And he died on the boat. And another guy and I had to decide whether he was really dead. You know how in the movies they just sort of reach down and look at somebody and they say, oh, he's dead. Well, it's not that easy. At least it wasn't for us. And so after putting things in front of his mouth and trying, we realized he was dead. And so a guy named Milt McCord and I had to dump him over the side. And that was a rough time because he was a good guy. And it's the first time I really was close to anyone dying.
And you had to be the one to declare that he was dead, and you weren't even...
Well, most...
That's certain.
Besides Milt McCord and I, two guys in the boat, were about the strongest in best conditions. A lot of the guys had swallowed a lot of oil, and some of them had gotten shrapnel from the when the torpedo went off. And so we were sort of in charge of the boat.
Do you think that... you had the courage to do certain things you might not have done if it wasn't for that experience?
I do. I think that it gave me a really strong feeling of my life force and a confidence in myself. I felt like I was a man. Before that point, for some reason, I always felt I was a boy. In fact, they called me the baby on the ship because I was the youngest guy on the ship. But I always felt that way. And then I felt that experience, because of the responsible nature that I found I acted all during that traumatic time, that I felt that I was a man.
Was being a cinematographer on commercial films any more gratifying earlier in your career, or is it more gratifying now? I'm wondering, in other words, how much the industry has changed, and if you have any more or less freedom, if you enjoy the films you're making any more or less.
The business has changed, and I use the word business very carefully, because when I first started making features, people made features because they wanted to make that picture, because that picture said something about humanity, said something about human relations, said something about something. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't make pictures to make money, but the commercial aspects of what is a good picture, a successful picture, has overridden what I think is some of the artistic benefits of movie making. That doesn't mean, I mean, I'm always surprised how many good pictures do get made, but the avalanche of pictures which are presented because of testing, because of trying to reach a certain audience in a certain way, leads to prefabricated ideas and repetitious ideas that don't really elevate the whole stature of motion picture business.
Well, Haskell Wexler, I wish we had more time to talk. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
A retrospective of Haskell Wexler's work will be presented by the Museum of the Moving Image in New York from April 3rd through the 25th. Wexler will speak at the museum on April 17th and 18th. He's featured in a new documentary about cinematographers called Visions of Light, and that will be shown at New York's Film Forum April 2nd through the 8th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tamara Davis was a young film director when music videos were also young. She got her start making videos for Sting, Bette Midler, and Tone Loc. She made the jump to feature films with Gun Crazy, starring Drew Barrymore. Davis's new film, CB4, satirizes the rap music scene. It stars Chris Rock of Saturday Night Live. Coming up, we'll talk with Tamara Davis. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews a new salsa recording featuring the singer India with Eddie Palmieri's band. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate fell one vote short this evening of stopping a Republican filibuster, blocking approval of a bill to make it easier to register to vote. The vote was 59-41 to end the filibuster, but 60 votes were needed in order to limit debate. Senate Democratic Leader George Mitchell says another vote will be held tomorrow morning, as he accused GOP lawmakers of gridlock on the issue. The so-called Voter Motor Bill would allow registration by mail, at motor vehicle offices, welfare agencies, and a number of other places where people apply for benefits and services of state and local governments. All the students from a suburban Detroit high school have been rescued after being stranded in the Great Smoky Mountains during a weekend blizzard. Kim Smith of member station WUOT reports on the first group of students rescued today.
The 16 Cranbrook Kingswood Upper School students greeted each other with tears and hugs once the Army helicopters touched down at the Tennessee Army National Guard base. The Army helicopters from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, hoisted them one by one into the choppers from the Smokies and brought them to Knoxville. Co-leader of the group, Megan Nealis, says she's glad to be out of there.
This has been an incredible experience, and but we were able, with the good weather the last 2 days, we were able to dry out and warm up, and thank God we have had no injuries.
Rescuers found 93 other members of the group yesterday. For National Public Radio, I'm Kim Smith in Knoxville, Tennessee.
And another group of 8 students was rescued late this afternoon. At least 14 people are dead and dozens more unaccounted for after a fire swept through a residential hotel on Chicago's near north side. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
Firefighters have not ruled out arson as a cause of the fire at the Paxson Hotel, but city and federal investigators are also considering other origins, including a space heater in one of the rooms that people with fixed incomes or low-paying jobs rented by the week or the month. The fire began shortly after 4 this morning and spread rapidly through the stairwells of the old brick hotel, said Chicago Fire Department spokesman Mike Cosgrove. He said there were working smoke detectors in the building, and residents were seen jumping from windows when firefighters arrived. At least 2 of the jumpers are among the dead. A dozen more residents are in serious condition at area hospitals. Other survivors were moved to transient hotels and to a YMCA nearby. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
At least 25 people have been killed in a bomb explosion in Calcutta. Some 60 people were injured in the blast that destroyed 2 apartment buildings. This occurs only 4 days after a series of bomb explosions in Bombay that killed more than 200 people and injured more than 1,000 others. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than a point in heavy trading. This is NPR News. As Bosnian peace talks are set to resume in New York City, Sarajevo has come under its heaviest attacks in weeks. Meanwhile, according to ham radio reports, several more villages in eastern Bosnia have fallen to Serbian forces, but this has not been officially confirmed. Aid convoys to besieged areas have been stopped from getting through, as Serbian leaders impose new conditions that UN officials have turned down. According to Bosnian government officials, at least 134,000 people are dead or missing in nearly 1 year of factional fighting. Following yesterday's failed election for a tax increase, school administrators in the northern Michigan city of Kalkaska announced today that they have no choice but to close their schools' doors next week, 10 weeks earlier than usual. Doug Johnson of Michigan Public Radio has more.
Twice this school year, Kalkaska school administrators had asked for a tax increase to help the district out of its growing debts. Twice, they were turned down. District officials had promised that if voters refused Monday's final request, the schools would be forced to shut early. Today, Superintendent Doyle Disbrow announced that on March 24th, school doors will close for the semester. Rick Ponstein, president of the Kalkaska Education Association, warns that without increased funding from the state, many other Michigan schools will face the same fate as Kalkaska.
At some point, we have to say that quality is what counts and that education is not inexpensive, but it's the backbone of our country, and we must fund it. We must have good education.
The State Department of Education estimates 20 other districts may go broke this year. For National Public Radio, this is Doug Johnson reporting.
Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen says $45 billion more is needed in the SNL bailout effort. So far, the government has spent $87 billion in the savings and loan scandal. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
I'm black, y'all, and I'm black, y'all, and I'm blacker than black, and I'm black, y'all. I'm blickety black, blacker than black, black, I'm blacker than black, yo, because I'm black and I'm black.
The whole rap music scene is satirized in the new film CB4. It's about three middle-class African-American friends who remake themselves into gangster rappers. Chris Rock of Saturday Night Live stars in the film. He also co-wrote it. Saturday Night Live's Phil Hartman plays a right-wing politician crusading against rap. CB4 was directed by my guest, Tamara Davis. It's her second feature. She also directed the recent independent film Gun Crazy, which starred Drew Barrymore. Davis got her start making music videos for rock and rap stars like Sting, Lou Reed, Sonic Youth, Tone Loc, Young MC, and MC Light. Here's a scene from CB4 in which the middle-class would-be gangster rappers are meeting with a record executive who's considering signing them.
Okay, guys, I love the image. But let me ask you one thing. Are you sure you want to be Gusto? Why not something like Ice Pick, Ice Coffee? I mean, ice is really happening right now. Let's get it started. So, I want you to sign with us, and you want to sign with us, and we want you to want to sign with us. Now, let me ask you guys a couple of questions. Do you cuss on your records?
Yeah.
Do you defile women with your lyrics?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, fondle your genitalia on stage?
Yeah.
Whenever possible.
Mm.
I asked Tamara Davis what she had to do to get in the spirit of this hip-hop parody.
I definitely felt, you know, when I was going in on these meetings that I knew that world, you know, from my experience, from my everyday life, you know, I definitely know that, you know, that rap world. And, you know, what I had to prove to them also is that I knew how to make a movie, which was Gun Crazy. So, you know, so that was interesting. The only thing that I felt, and the studio or, you know, all the powers that be felt that they didn't know for sure, was my ability to work with comedy. And, you know, that's where Chris Rock comes in, because he's supposed to be funny, you know. So, you know, it was interesting. So what I did is I didn't really go and look at, you know, I'm around rap all the time. So I kind of more tried to watch comedies to try to figure out, how do I make a comedy? And it's like on Gun Crazy, I could look at all these amazing, you know, film noir films, or, you know, there's so much that you could take from. And I mean, you know, you look at Naked Gun or the Bill Murray, whatever, all the contemporary lampoon comedies, there's nothing as a filmmaker that you get inspired from, like, oh God, I want to do something like that. And so the only person that I really loved his comedies is Woody Allen. As a filmmaker, he's, you know, a genius comedy maker. And that was definitely one of the first films Chris Rock told me to see. He's like, go see Take the Money and Run, you know, and, you know, that's what we want to do. And so so that's kind of how I really, you know, most of my work and, you know, was looking at Woody Allen. And then, you know, this, when we got the Go project, I had 6 weeks to prepare, you know, to shoot this incredible, huge musical comedy, you know, whatever. So it was basically just like, you know, dive in and, you know, sink or swim.
You know a lot about hip-hop culture. How do you know so much about it in addition to having shot rap videos?
I'm a young person. It's the music I listen to a lot. You know, I go to clubs that, you know, where that music's around. I did a TV show for Fox called Pump It Up, which was, you know, a rap magazine show hosted by Dee Barnes. And, you know, that was, you know, I worked with a lot of amazing people, learned there. I'm married to a guy who's in the Beastie Boys. And, you know, so my, you know, if I've been with him for 4.5 years, so, you know, I'm completely surrounded by that in a way. But, you know, I also have a completely normal life. But, you know, I know that whole that whole world.
How did you start making rock and rap videos?
Well, I started wanting to make films, going to film school, you know, really just, you know, wanting to become a feature director. And, you know, when I got out of film school at 23 years old, nobody, you know, it was like a joke. Nobody in Hollywood was ready for, you know, the new young female director. So it was amazing, though, because MTV at that time, this is 8 years ago, you know, was open to anything new. And so I started doing kind of like alternative videos for Husker Du, True Believers, like all these college kind of bands. And then I did all these English videos, whatever, The Smiths, Depeche Mode, you know, all that style. And then these friends of mine had a label called Delicious Vinyl. And I said, I love rap music. And I did Tone Loc's Wild Thing for, you know, $350. And, you know, and that was, a lot of people thought that was my first video, but that was like my entrance into rap videos. And continually in music videos, I mean, the same month I was doing a Bette Midler video, I was doing an NWA video. The same month I was doing a Sonic Youth video, I was doing a New Kids on the Block video. So in music videos, you know, you vary a lot. And, you know, and the way I work is I also vary my style a lot. So, you know, you're pretty broad if you're really working a lot in that industry. So
when you've directed rap videos or in directing the new rap parody CB4, do you get any surprised reactions because you're white?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's, you know, I mean, that was like, you know, BET comes onto the set and they interview all these people, all the producers.
BET's Black
and
Entertainment
cast.
Television.
Yeah, Black, you know, and then they come to me and it's like, you know, me sitting in the chair, this blonde white girl, you know. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it is different. And I don't know what to say about it other than it's, you know, I felt really confident knowing, you know, the world I was doing and also knowing that I could make a film. And I mean, the most positive thing I could say is that, you know, it doesn't really matter who you are and what you look like if you're trying to direct. I mean, if I thought that myself, all my heroes were these, like, you know, big, strong-looking men with cigars in their mouths. And, you know, it's like, I don't think it really matters what the person is. It really, you know, you just try to make the best film and, you know, you know, hopefully, you know, to break those stereotypes of, you know, what a director should look like to do something, you know.
Do you ever feel that you have to work extra hard to prove yourself because you're white and because you're a woman when you're working on a hip-hop film or video?
I think that I'm so busy doing whatever the job I'm doing, it's like if I had to worry about trying to prove myself, I'd be in trouble because, you know, there's a lot of stuff you have to really worry about. I think that you know, when I first did my first video with NWA and I stepped out there and they looked at me and, you know, they all made their jokes and I stood up to it, I think, you know, I proved myself then, you know, whatever, 4 years ago, that no matter what people say, you know, that I was able to do it and then also able to become, you know, be successful with it, do something that, you know, was exactly what the product was supposed to be. You know, so, you know, I think that it's interesting to be, you know, to be this. So it's, you know, it's trying to get past those stereotypes, which, you know, what, I think is an important thing.
What were some of those jokes that NWA made?
I don't want to tell you. I probably can't say it on the air, but, you know, they're things that, you know, any group of, you know, 8 hardcore guys would say to a white girl, you know, and you can't like get offensive. You just stand up and you know, and then you just do your job. And, you know, I did my job and, you know, and I did something good. And now, you know, now it's like a different situation. You know, it's like, you know, I know those guys and it's okay. I mean, not like I really support all the stuff that they're doing, but, you know, you have to stand up to that stuff. You can't, like, just run or something or, like, start an argument. You just do what you're supposed to do, what you need to do, you know.
Right, you can't turn it into, like, a political discussion.
No.
Right.
No. Uh-uh.
My guest is Tamara Davis, director of CB4 and Gun Crazy. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Film director Tamara Davis is my guest. Let me ask you about your first feature film, Gun Crazy, which is, by the way, on video now. Drew Barrymore stars in it as a teenage girl who is sexually abused by her mother's boyfriend and by just about all the boys in the area. She really has, like, no understanding of her own self-worth, and she ends up with an ex-con. And do you want to take it from there and explain a little bit more?
We started the movie out that, you know, that a lot of bad things were happening to her, and she just kind of, like, was this type of person that this stuff just happens to. It's almost like a dog that just keeps getting kicked and just thinks that that's the way to be, is just like a kicked dog. And then something happens in her life that she still has the ability to love and have hope, and she meets this guy that she thinks, you know, is going to be this, like, you know, whatever, this person for her. And then, you know, because they have a fascination with guns, a lot of things go bad for them.
Drew Barrymore really gives a wonderful performance in the role. I'm wondering what your way was into her character. She's someone who lives in a trailer. She's from a pretty poor background. No obvious way for her to get out of that. And as I said, you know, someone with very little sense of her self-worth. What have you experienced that helped you understand that character?
I myself didn't experience this, but, you know, I went to school in the San Fernando Valley, and there were girls that were the girls that slept around with guys. And I think the biggest thing that I wanted to say as a woman, that it's not always the girl that wears, like, the tank tops and the little tube tops and hot pants that is being sexually abused. A lot of times it's these girls that are wearing, like, you know, or just, like, they're physically different, you know. And, you know, it's, I just wanted to show that it wasn't these, like, you know, the girls that are out there asking for it. A lot of this stuff really goes on unnoticed in America. And, you know, I drove around throughout the middle of the country a little bit. And, you know, we went and stayed in this town called Ely, Nevada. And, you know, Drew and I, we both did some really good research there of just, like, regular girls, because, you know, both of us live in Los Angeles. And, you know, it's hard to see what the rest of the country's like living here.
The town that you went to that you just mentioned? What are some of the things you found there that ended up in the movie?
Kind of just that whole thing that when you're the bad girl in town, people laugh at you and people whisper behind your back, and you're constantly, like, snickered at, and but yet, you know, just like this wanting to be liked, and that they're the popular girls and the unpopular girls, and kind of just like this, and also this just I don't want to say slow, you know, like, I mean, in a city, there's so many things that are happening really fast, whereas out in the country, things happen a little slower and go by a little bit more unnoticed, it seems, you know, certain things. And I don't know, pink satin jackets. All the girls were wearing pink satin jackets in this town.
So did you try to find the bad girl of the town to see what her experiences were like?
No, what we did is, Drew, even in this little town, she would, like, walk down the street. There were, like, 8 boys, like, building, you know, I don't know, hanging outside. And, I mean, you know, I'm walking with her, and she would walk up to these boys and say, you know, hi, or, you know, whatever, and talk to these kids. And it was kind of like she was acting like the bad girl in town. We went to this, like, teen disco, and she just did this dance with this boy that, you know, and, you know, I saw, like, the popular girls, what their reaction was, and the boys that, you know, how they, you know, kind of all paid attention to her. And, you know, it was interesting. So we didn't really find the bad girl. I think Drew tried to do that for us.
Hey, Nita, is it true you let Joanne Allen do it to you?
What'd they say?
They said you did. I believe so. Look, you know you're pissed off at us for us giving you such a hard time at school,
but you realize at the end of time, we wouldn't be such dicks about it if maybe you were possibly nice to us, like you were nice to Joey and Butthead. Those guys are fags. Yeah.
That's why we're mad at you. It's only because we like you.
You guys really like me?
Anita. Of course we do, Anita. I'm hurt.
Well, I guess I like you guys, too. But you promised not to tell.
We're not going to tell no one, Anita.
Don't worry. I
promise.
It's interesting to me that you've directed a lot of videos, and videos are usually edited in a really rapid style. You know, what you're seeing changes every few seconds. And that's not at all the language that you used for Gun Crazy.
No.
I think, you know, our listeners might assume that it had that, like, jumpy, stylish attitude of videos, and you came up with a different visual language for Gun Crazy. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for myself, I approach each project, you know, whatever, with whatever your limitations and your benefits are. On Gun Crazy, we had 23 days to shoot. And so that meant that I didn't have a lot of time to do lots of different shots. Basically, I had to get scenes in sometimes one or two different shots. And sometimes, you know, whatever, I only had like a couple takes to do. So, you know, Lisa and I, we went back and we watched like a lot of Orson Welles films, because he would move the camera and the actors within the shot without cutting. And, you know, every time you cut, it takes so long to, you know, it takes an hour to move a camera and reset the lights and all that stuff. So I designed it so there weren't a lot of shots, because, I couldn't do a lot of shots. And I mean, I felt the movie was, you know, it doesn't really lend itself to that. I mean, you know, music videos is a whole different medium. And, you know, maybe you could work that medium into a documentary. But, you know, a movie's a totally different thing. So, you know, I really didn't want to make the mistake of doing a 90-minute music video.
Tamara Davis, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tamara Davis directed the new movie CB4 and Gun Crazy, which is out on home video. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about Republicans in Washington who've complained to President Clinton about his economic package. They say it contains too many defense cuts and too much economic stimulus. Like, a little bit less of both. Also, news today of the political corruption scandals in Italy. The government of Prime Minister Amato survived a confidence vote today. But we'll be hearing from a journalist who says that really the scandals we're seeing are a sign of Italy entering the post-Cold War world. We'll also be hearing a review of the prosecution's case in the trial of Los Angeles police officers charged with depriving Rodney King of his civil rights.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every kind of music has mastered talent spotters whose bands spin off more than their share of stars. Critic Milo Miles points to Eddie Palmieri as one of salsa's talent spotters, and he has a tip about his latest discovery.
Unless you dare to count Gloria Estefan, there hasn't been a dynamite young woman vocalist in a high-profile salsa band in a long time. A woman by the name of India remedies that with her solo debut called Llegó la India via Eddie Palmieri, which makes a convincing case that she's a new breed of Latina spitfire. Her voice isn't enormous, but it's lean and steely with a fine feline growl. More important, her delivery is brash enough to cut through the band's polyrhythms and take charge.
Thank you.
Singers tend to be a bit decorative in salsa bands. They're flashy visual pinups for the crowd while the band's arranger and songwriter is the star behind the scenes. Indeed, instrumental solos and groove explorations get at least as much space in a tune as the vocalist. India is a protege of veteran Eddie Palmieri, whose band plays here, but she doesn't sound subsumed on her own album. Her participation has streamlined his arrangements. He's lightened up on an obsessive quest for the perfect rock, soul, salsa, funk fusion, and he's pared back the jazzy elaborations that had become predictable over the years. Instead, you have a top-flight dance band with nothing to prove but plenty to offer. Examples include Palmieri's sculptured swirl of a piano solo on Vivir Sin Ti and Milton Cardona's firmly rooted percussion. There's even a smart mutant merengue. India's album fudges one item. There's three versions of the weepy number Solitude Soledad, one in English, one in Spanish, and a bilingual. The bilingual alone would have been fine, and what the program really wants is two more quality ballads, not nine redundant minutes of the same tune. But as everyone knows, concocting a great ballad is lots harder than pumping out up-tempo tracks. But when the fast dances are pumped out with India's sass, the slow ones can wait till next time.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He reviewed Jago La India via Eddie Palmieri on the Soho label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Sue Weinstein and Bill Duhart. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about recent developments in the Islamic world, from violence against Muslims in Bosnia and India to the continuing growth of Islamic fundamentalism and what that means for the rest of the world. My guest will be Abdulaziz Sachedina, a professor of Islamic studies. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.